Welcome to Inside Analog Photography Radio Program. I'm your host, Scott Shepard, and of course, the Inside Analog Photography Radio Program is all about traditional process photography. We talk about instant photography. We talk about black and white. We talk about color film. We talk about dry plate, wet plate, you name it, alternate printing processes, everything going on in analog photography. And of course, the Inside Analog Photography Radio Program is brought to you by Fujifilm over at www.fujifilmusa.com/professional. They have beautiful C41 color neg, black and white, color chrome, and of course, instant. Instant film rocks. These guys have so much great things going on right now with instant film. Of course, they have the pack film in 3.25 by 4.25 and 4.5 color, black and white, high speed black and white. But you know what's even cooler? They have the Instax cameras and film. The Instax Wide is in the country, available everywhere. And of course, right now, brand new, the Instax Mini is now in the U.S. They have cameras. They have film. This Instax Mini is 2.5 by 3.5. It's the size of a business card. This is really fun stuff. You got to check it out. www.fujifilmusa.com/professional, making life more colorful. Our friends at Richard Photo Lab, the place to send all your film to get developed, proofs, you name it. They got a great workflow going. www.richardphotolab.com, DR5. For the most unbelievable proprietary process to turn your black and white film into positives, into chrome. You won't believe until you get your film back as a piece of chrome will blow your mind. The dynamic range, the latitude, it's just unbelievable stuff. Definitely check it out, www.dr5.com. Iger Studios, Lenny Iger, the place to have high-resolution scans done. You know, a lot of people now are shooting analog. They're using a high-resolution scan. They're making digital negatives on an inkjet, or maybe they're going straight to an inkjet output. But they're making digital negatives and they're printing contact prints. They're doing all the stuff you need to get a high resolution scan. They're using an Aztec Premier, 8,000 PPI, adjustable aperture. They can give you scans that are basically grain free. They can adjust it for every kind of film out there. This is crazy stuff going on with Lenny Iger and the guys at Iger Studios. Check them out, igerstudios.com. And of course, Upstrap at upstrap-pro.com. The camera strap that will not slide off your shoulder. Our media partners, www.apug.org, the Analog Photography User Group, the place on the web for all things analog process. This is a great place to learn, to share information, to get tips and tricks. The community for analog photography, www.apug.org. And of course, our photographic philanthropy partner, George Eastman House International Museum of Photography and Film, www.geh.org, the place to go to find out about the history of traditional analog photography. These people are keeping this alive. They have over 7,000 cameras in their museum of everything that's ever been made, including the Hasselblads that were shot on the moon. You name it, they have the collection. This is a great way to help support. You can be a member of George Eastman House organization. They have a lot of great things going on, but this is something you can do to help give back to photography, to help keep traditional analog photography alive for generations to come. Definitely check them out, www.geh.org. This week on Inside Analog Photography Radio Program, we're going to have with us Eddie Soloway. Eddie is the natural eye. Eddie is a photographer out of Santa Fe, New Mexico. Eddie teaches at the Santa Fe workshops. Eddie's an all-around cool guy, and guess what? He loves film. He loves film more than you can even imagine. He makes beautiful photography. He's an acclaimed teacher. He's a really cool guy. You can't believe this beautiful work that Eddie's doing, and his teaching is unbelievable. Eddie, how you doing today, buddy?
I'm pretty good, Scott. Good to be here.
Thanks for joining us here on Inside Analog Photo. Great to have you on the program. Eddie, you're a professional photographer out of the Santa Fe, New Mexico area. You do a lot of teaching. You've been doing a lot of cool stuff here lately, but give our listeners a little background on Eddie. When did you get into photography?
Well, photography's been a part of my life since, before high school, but seriously, I'd say about 1990s when I really dove into it. Before that, my path was about environmental education. I majored in ecology. So nature's been the core that's run through my life, but photography rose up in the early 90s in a real strong way.
So when you were a kid, you shot photos. Did you do the black and white darkroom deal in the bathroom? How did you actually get to the point to where in the 90s, after this other educational opportunities and the stuff you were doing with the environment, brought photography into the mix?
When I flash back, I remember a garage sale when I was, I think, in about 7th grade. Bought a little tiny 35mm camera, put black and white film in there. I built a extremely rudimentary darkroom. I mean, that didn't have an enlarger. So remember Codalith?
Yep.
I was making Codalith sandwiches and things like that in the basement. But then in high school, took a black and white printing class. Also, in high school, a friend of my parents had a color darkroom back in the days when you'd put the roll tube chemistry. Be working in total darkness and the paper go in, I can't remember how many chemicals, a bunch of them, and minutes later out came this print. So it started there, but what I think the crucial thing for me was in the years when I wasn't making photographs, in the 80s in particular, I was working in a field where my job was to see the natural world with fresh eyes, to bring some creative ideas to teachers trying to turn their kids onto the natural world. So I was outside all the time, I was looking, I was seeing. A lot of my, you might say, inspiration or mentors at the time were writers, actually. People like Gary Snyder and Barry Lopez and Annie Dillard and folks like that. So a lot of my ideas for seeing without me knowing it were being developed back then. So when I picked up a camera again about 1990, there was a difference in my eye. It was a fun shift. I've often said that years ago what I was doing was photographing just objects and things. There's a speck of dust on the slide that was really an eagle and just doing a poor job of it. But I don't know, somehow when I picked up the camera again, I was more interested in this idea of the magic of moments and the essence of places. And that kind of drives me a lot today.
So tell me the story about you dropping your rig into the soup in Florida and then taking a break from shooting for a while.
Some of that, sort of what I just mentioned, but I was down camping in the Everglades, down Cape Sable, the southernmost point of the continental U.S., was looking for shells and had a 35mm old Nikon with me, and I had it in a sort of side pack. Wasn't very careful, reached over into the Florida Bay to pick up a shell, and the camera tumbled into the water and was instantly ruined. And the interesting thing for me was, sure, at the time I was pissed. I was really upset about it. But thereafter, for a number of years, it was like a relief. I didn't have to bring the camera with me because at that time in my life, I was just really making sort of natural history pictures. So here's a photograph of an osprey. Here's one of an orchid and so on. And none of it real thoughtfully, just more like notches or like a checklist almost. I saw that, and so on. From that point on, I was working with this group that I just mentioned a bit ago, trying to come up with really creative ways for teachers to work with kids outdoors. So it was interesting. Let go of the camera, and then I think instead of it being a burden, bringing it along, I was just seeing the world happily. So when a camera showed up again, I could put the two together, the seeing and the camera.
Eddie, let's chat about the landscape photographer, the person that wants to go out and shoot nature. Like you said, a lot of people try to document what they see. And then there's some people like yourself that can grab something different. There's something different about your photography. So, like you said, I think it's part of your natural eye. It's a training that you were doing and just looking at stuff differently. But I think a lot of people go out and want to shoot landscapes. And sometimes I even wonder why.
Well, it can be very intimidating to look at what's been done already, but one of the things that I really think about a lot these days is that we tend to run out with a camera. I mean, I'll do this in a workshop. I'll notice we'll talk about the idea of capturing the essence of a place, and I'll give people some ideas, mainly ideas like slowing down and just sitting for a while or wandering slowly, and half the group at least will do the exact opposite. They'll just, within moments from the vehicle, start snapping away. And I think that a lot of what's built the foundation for me is just years and years in the thing itself. In the natural world, for me, seeing. And then it's both being in it, first-hand experience, but then it's bringing some sort of thoughtfulness to it. And that comes from reading poems, reading some of my favorite natural history writers, from going to galleries and museums, and knowing that there's a different way to interpret something. So it's that combination, I guess, of being in it a lot, and then swimming in the concepts and ideas and thoughtfulness. And over time and commitment starts rising up as different kinds of work, or different creative expressions of the landscape.
Sure, and you always hear the thing from the great street photographers and people capturing the decisive moment. Is there such thing as a decisive moment in natural photography and shooting nature?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, there is. I mean, it depends a little bit on, in my case, what I'm working on. But yeah, sure, there's a moment when the light just glistens in a particular way. There's many moments where it doesn't work. And so while I'm not photographing animals, let's say, where there might be a corollary between something leaping, like Cartier Bresson's leap over the puddle and an antelope or a deer or something leaping. But there are definitely moments where you go, yes, that's it. I just think about Cartier Bresson now as yes, yes, yes. I mean, there's moments where the light unfolds and everything comes together. And I think it's being out there a lot, knowing that that can happen and being able to read that particular light. So that's a good question, but I think you're right. There are decisive moments.
How do you keep enthused about your nature photography when you've been doing it for so many years? And like you said, there's so many people that have been doing it for 150 years plus now. How do you train the eye, or how do you think about what you're going to shoot comparative to, well, okay, I'm in this environment. Is it better to get low, go high? What do you look at when you're looking around? Because like you said, there's a lot of people that have done all this stuff. And how do you make something fresh?
Interesting, yeah. I'm thinking of a bunch of different things at once, Scott. I mean, part of it is, going back to what I just said, sort of swimming in other creative interpretations, looking at the way abstract painters work, or reading a poem carefully and getting a phrase out of it. Whitman talked about a redwood tree murmuring out of its myriad branches. Well, there's a visual right there. And I just get excited about that. I think I'm just curious. And so I will run for a while on a particular thought or a particular idea. George O'Keefe and some of the abstract painters were talking about how details got in the way. And I started thinking about that and worked on a series of forest abstracts where I'm moving the camera gently during the exposure and as a result really celebrating color, light, and shape and letting go of a lot of the real details. Well, that can excite me a lot. And if I come back with a kernel of something good, I guess as a side thought, I've learned that it takes a long time to flush out something good in a body of work. But if something comes back with a little bit of excitement in it, that just turns me up. I just want to go, go, go. And I guess I'm curious, and I also understand if you're committed to something, if you work at it for long enough, the success shows up. And yeah, I like that idea. Just another thought that popped in, too, was sort of how you started the question. One of the things that keeps me going is the fact that since I am a working professional right now, so much of the time is not making photographs, which everyone's surprised by when they want to switch their careers and become photographers. So the time making photographs becomes precious. And I wonder what it would be like if 100% of my time were free just to make photographs. But it's swimming in all kinds of photography right now. So when I get those moments and when I make them to be outside, it's beyond precious. I honor it.
How do you sort of plan for your time when you do have time to go shoot? Because like you said, as being a professional photographer, you have to do stuff in the darkroom. You got to make prints. You have to mount stuff. You got to go to FedEx. You got to go deal with this. You got to market. You got to tweet. You got to blog. I mean, it gets to the point to where there's no time to do your craft.
It's insane. Yeah, it's totally insane. I mean, somebody came into a gallery show that I had some work up, and they said, gosh, I'd love to be a photographer and travel all over the world all the time. And I said, me too. They looked at me with surprise. I said, well, most of my time's not making the photograph. And that's the crazy part of it. But what I've learned to do after a couple years where I made the mistake of letting everything else drive the schedule, meaning art shows and workshops and speaking engagements and letting that just drive me, I took it more by the reins last year and said, no, I need to build in these times that are blocked off from the calendar just for me to go somewhere and make photographs or go write. And I'm up against that right now, thinking of 2010.
Well, that's the thing. I think no matter what you do, if you're into photography, you need to chisel out a time. It's like, okay, well, Saturday, I'm shooting photos, and I don't care if it's in the backyard or if I'm going to the other side of the planet. You need to censor these times out because people get so busy, and I don't understand why this stuff is so important to a certain level of everything else in life, but it just cuts down on anything that you want to do photographically. It sort of gets almost to a bummer at some point to where there's so much stuff to deal with and so much email and so much this and so much that, that I think people lose track of your time as a photographer.
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, you just have to all of a sudden wake up and go, wait, this stuff's running my life, and that's not the way it's supposed to be. I mean, when you die, the inbox is still going to keep filling up and you never be able to answer all the email. So it's like, are you going to let that run your life? Or are you going to go say, no, the reason I'm doing this is because of the experiences in the natural world or street photography or whatever. I'm going to lead with that. And you're exactly right.
Well, here's a good one for you. Let's do a little scenario that's really off topic. But let's say it's 30 years ago, 40 years ago, when there was no email and there was no Twitter and there was no web.
Right.
Things seemed to work pretty well then.
Yeah, in many ways. I mean, there's goods and bads. I mean, let's see, where was it? Late 90s, mid 90s, I was seriously trying to get this all going. And I printed a brochure, went up to Oregon to Beyond Press, and it was a several panel brochure of my current work. Then down the road, that becomes obsolete, and you want to print another one. It worked just fine for a while. People called when they had an order, or don't faint, but they put something in the mail and mailed it to you and said they'd like to get this. But on the other hand, it's rather incredible how I'm just about to release a DVD. And I got a DVD order yesterday from the Netherlands and two from Canada. And it's like, they wouldn't have found me from a brochure. And so it's a good and bad thing. I think it's controlling the technology. That's the key.
I guess just more about life management in general.
Yeah, I think it really is. We're here for a short time. And how do you want to spend that time?
Yeah, I just look at some of our friends that are in this corporate environment. It's like basically they're stuck on a crackberry 24/7. And it's just nonstop. And it's like you want to grab it and just throw it in the soup.
And relating to that, I mean, look at where photography is right now, too. Not only how we manage our own time, but look at what the photographer's being told these days. They're being told that they need to embrace every new software release, that not only that, they've got to get all sorts of plugins. I did this little thing in my blog just the other day. I brought my son's video camera up to this cabin in Maine, stuck it on a tripod, and every now and then when I had a thought, I just recorded it. And I put one up the other day, which really alludes to this idea, called it main stage and sideshows. And for me, the main stage is I want to spend as much time as I can being in the natural world, experiencing it, photographing it, writing. And yet along the way, there's all these things harping at you, little sideshows just begging you to come in and try HDR or try some plugin. And I just made a flip remark on this little video diary that I'd made about, I thought lenses used to sharpen things. And now we're convinced we've got to buy plugins and learn them. And it's just nonstop. And yeah, I agree with you about mutual friends and folks out there that really make a living off of every new software release. And I think the difficult thing is that for the beginner, they're convinced that they've got to have all that stuff. And there again, getting back to how you started this, they're never going to get outdoors if all they're doing is paying attention to that stuff. And just to finish the thought, with a simple camera, and whether it's digital or film, a couple little things, and be outside and see, you're going to make memorable photographs.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, and I think that's one thing here that's driving a resurgence in analog photography, is people are fried. They're done buying a new body every year, 18 months. They're done with every software upgrade every year. I mean, by the time it's said and done, literally, if you got the newest body every year, the updated glass, and the updated software, and then the computer systems and the storage to go with it, you could easily spend, I'm sure, $10,000 plus a year, minimum.
Oh, easily. It depends where you're at in photography. If you're playing the game on the high road and you enter the digital world, depending on whether you're shooting Nikon or Canon, you're spending $5,000 to $8,000 a year. That's for one camera, and most of my friends needed two. So there's $10,000 to $16,000 to play at the high level. And 18 months later, you've got to replace those. And granted, we're living at the beginning of a revolution. Things may stabilize. But I just laugh when people say digital's free. It's like, what? It's just what you said. No, you're spending a ton of money on digital. It's when you've bought it all that you press the shutter, you don't have to process the film. My cameras from the 80s still work. I paid for them a long time ago. And I shoot digitally too, and I do like it. But I think we have to be real careful of this idea that digital's free and watch our time involvement.
The only thing that I'm really liking on digital these days is just the really high ISO.
That's what brought me into buying one for the first time. And I'm trying to be picky. I bought a Nikon D700, and I found at 800 I was happy with the ISO. Above that, if I wanted to make a big print, I could still see noise. And I'm not in front of the monitor a lot, so I don't know about all the plugins and things to get rid of noise. But I agree with you. And it's fun feedback on some things that I do, some motion work. But honestly, this work I was doing where I was moving the camera during the exposure, looking at forest or water, it was all done on film, and people assume it's done digitally, but it was all done on film. I don't know. It didn't hold me back at all. And I'll say one thing is that the only thing that if I went into, let's say, an autumn forest with an idea and worked it hard, and I've learned to work it really hard in all different ways, and it didn't quite work out, I've got to wait a year again for autumn. Sometimes digital has, in some ways, been able to give me instant feedback. I'm on the right path with the motion or the exposure.
Maybe the digital D700 needs to go with you so you can use it as, i.e., the old Polaroid, and then grab your film camera to capture the essence of what you're trying to do.
Well, here's the crazy thing is that you look at photographs. I had the chance this year, Jay Mazel invited me over to his studio. I was in New York speaking, and what a thrill to see this five-story bank building he has. And he showed me some unbelievable prints from the Nikon D3 or D3X. And the detail's unbelievable. And on that level, what he was doing with the people and places, gosh, it was just exquisite work. And you didn't even ask the question, digital or film. You just went, wow. And yet, put that together with another thing, which is I've noticed that in the prints that I bring into the world, because one of the biggest pieces of my photographic pie is making prints. And when I look at the prints I like, most of them, 9 out of 10, were shot on film. And there's this textural quality. And I don't know if it's grain. It just, I think of it as a textural difference. And I noticed that last year. So this year, for instance, when I went up to northern Maine to photograph autumn, I really took a step forward with the film. Last year, it fell back. The digital was so instant. You know, I just did that. But when I came back and realized that the film images were the ones I wanted to print, I said, wake up, pay attention, and lead with film. You're right, I did bring the D700 along for, well, two things. One was high ISO exposures I wanted to play with, freezing and stopping water, but also almost like a Polaroid, a proof of what I was doing with the film.
Eddie, let's chat about your prints. Tell me about your print process. Are you doing all this stuff hybrid now with an inkjet output? Are you still printing silver print? Tell me what you're doing with your prints.
Yeah, a bunch of different things. I was a darkroom rat back in San Francisco. I worked for a company called Frog Prints. It was like turning a frog into a prince, but it sounded like photographic prints. It was a great place, so a small little lab doing color dye transfer work, silver gelatin, and also C prints from negatives or internegatives. It was the perfect place to work because the owner was extremely picky in a great way, and he made us really finesse prints. We learned that every single piece of film coming in, even if the client wanted it to match the chrome, let's say, had our hands all over it. That was a great, great learning ground. So then I left there and came to New Mexico. I started thinking, well, what do I do? I rented a lab in Albuquerque for a while where I could after-hours print from internegatives or negatives, and just wasn't happy with the quality I was getting from the internegative. It was that time that some digital processes started rising up, and looked at them carefully, and the one that I settled on was doing real high-end scans of my chromes at the time. I'm going to switch to shooting color and eggs now, but real high-end scans of the chromes, and then doing my darkroom work on the monitor. And it was a big learning process. So actually, early on, I moved over to digital color printing. It took a long time for me to switch to digital capture in the camera. What I found was the most stable process that I like, because flashback, this is now 13, 14 years ago, maybe something like that, right at the beginning of it all. It was the light jet process I liked the best. And that's where laser light burns red, green, and blue into photographic paper, into darkroom C-print paper. And it was a very tight system. The colors were beautiful. The longevity was just fine. And inkjets at the time were not stable. I remember making some test prints, and they faded within 3 months. And then 10 years, I guess it went up to. But now I'm actually looking at inkjet because I've seen some just drop-dead gorgeous inkjet prints. Actually, I was at Photokina last year and saw in the Epson booth, there were some Epson prints on Hanamule papers that just blew me away. Anyway, on the color side, I'm still printing light jet. I like it a lot. I do all the work, and then I send my files off to Autumn Color Digital Imaging in Worcester, Massachusetts, because these machines are about $250,000. So I definitely do all the same darkroom work, and then they just put it in the soup, you might say. On the other side, I've been fascinated by alternative processes. Started working with palladium and platinum, then started doing large digital negs that I would print out on an inkjet printer on Pictorico clear transparency film, then contact those on the palladium, which then led me into the gravure process and looked at both copper plate and a polymer plate and liked the polymer for the low toxicity and the really beautiful tonal range and do those as well too. I think the reason I went from color over into that, and I do both now, is because I love the tactile qualities of inking up a plate and hand-pulling them. If anyone's ever seen the old work of Edward Curtis, the portraits of the Native Americans, those were gravures. Gravures were included in the Camera Works or Camera Arts, I'm not sure, a magazine from Steichen's days way back. So kind of doing different things with printing.
I think you're definitely correct on this hybrid workflow. I mean, so difficult anymore to even go somewhere to learn the craft and the art of darkroom printing. And with this technology, that you can shoot analog, scan your print, and then do your light dodge burn contrast controls in Photoshop, and then output it digitally, like you said, to a light jet Durst. Or even now with the inkjet, I'm sure the stuff that you saw at Jay's studio off of his high-end Epsons were probably pretty good.
Oh, just beautiful. So I think whether someone went with inkjet or lightjet right now, you could be quite happy. You touched on something that's interesting to me, too, is I'm real thankful to have had an analog background in that I watch this a lot when I teach at different workshops or if I poke my head into the digital labs. People will make a print, and they'll make one, and if it's kind of okay, they say, yep, there we go, that's it. And I just remember that story, though, about how every single piece of film through the photo lab in San Francisco, we had our hands all over it just to make it look like how the film was, which was a fairly simple request as opposed to opening shadows and holding down highlights and things. So it's knowing that when I scan a piece of film, or if I shoot digitally in RAW, let's say, I still have to work this carefully because it's just a beginning interpretation. RAW files and film are limited in terms of what they can see compared to the eye and our imaginations and ideas. So, yeah, I'm just thankful that I had that owner in San Francisco that made us take peeps and tweaks and so on, magenta out of clouds, and no one else could notice, but they trained our eyes to notice it.
Hey, let's talk about gear. What are you shooting with these days? Of course, I know you have the D700 for any kind of digital or proof work you're working on, but let's talk about your analog gear and what you're doing.
Yeah, analog, I have a couple of Nikon FM2s, had them for a long time. They are perfect. I felt guilty. All my friends were spending so much money on digital, so I took it into a repair shop just to have them look at it and clean it. And I think it was about almost 20 years old, and he said, shutter's right on. I said, I blew some dust out of it. It's still working great. So that's what I use on 35. the most important other body work right now doing with palladium or the gravir. And I just shoot with an old plastic. It's like a Holga. I love the name. It's called a Debonair. And it was one of those $20 plastic 120 millimeter cameras. Also, occasionally, I'm going to pull out the old, I've got a Wisner 4x5, beautiful old wooden field camera. Pulled out a few years ago to experiment with some very selective focus work, and I want to get that back out again this year. Those are the main cameras. There's an old Mamiya 6-7RZ that was way too heavy to buy, but bought it on a silly whim. Used from a store in San Francisco, but don't use it that much right now. So FM2 is my workhorse on 35.
So let's talk about capture emulsion. What do you like to shoot on?
Well, I've switched. It's interesting. In terms of the color world, I was always shooting chromes. And I was shooting between Fuji and Kodak. It just depended. I'd sort of blew with the wind a little bit when I was beginning, listening to what the pros were all saying, not understanding the journey that someone's in a magazine saying, shoot with this. They're obviously being paid for it. So I would buy that film and want to be like them. But I started with chromes, and I would occasionally shoot with color neg, basically in that plastic camera because it had a wider latitude. Then about a year and a half ago, I guess it was, got a call from Scott DiSabato over at Kodak. And he said that they were working on a new film, and he heard that I shot film, and would I try it? It's out now. It's the Ektar 100. I said, sure. And I really liked it, but I was confused about the workflow. So used to getting chromes back and looping them and being able to figure it out from there. And made the mistake at the beginning with this Ektar of getting contact sheets. But then if you're going to scan, it was just too much work. And then it occurred to me, and it was easy to do, to, from the photo lab, just ask for a CD. They gang a whole bunch of rolls on the same CD and really tiny little scans, and then I can just proof that way very quickly. So, yeah, these days I'm shooting when it's 35, it's the Ektar 100, and goof around with higher speeds too for low light work occasionally. And on the black and white side, for a long time, just for fun when I shoot my son, I use the Tri-X 400. But I also have liked Ilford made a Delta 3200. I would play with it for a while in the plastic camera. Those different films, I guess.
So let's talk about this transition of moving from pause to neg, from shooting chrome to a C41 color neg. Tell me how that worked out with what you were using previously to what you're using now. How was that transition?
Well, I mean, it was awkward at first because I kept wanting to bring chrome film with me, and there was no reason to. But it reminds me of a story. A long time ago, I had a 35mm camera. I bought a medium format. It was back at the photo lab days in San Francisco. And a buddy of mine, we were rolling dye transfer prints next to each other every day, and he said, hey, how's that new medium format? And I said, nah, I don't know. I try it, and then I always grab the 35. And he said, well, leave the 35 at home for the next trip. And I was like, oh, no, how can I do that? And I did, and then I got to know it. Well, same thing happened with the negative. I left the chromes behind and forced myself into only the Ektar. And now it's second nature. It's what I do. And what I like about it, it's got a little bit greater tonal range than slides. There again, good training to have in slides because if you're off a stop, you blew it. But it's got a better tonal range. It has almost no grain. That's what's the wild thing about it. I guess they say it's the world's finest grain film, and I believe it. And the color saturation looks like a chrome film. So you put that together, almost no grain, great colors, and not a bias towards one, just great colors. And then you've got a nice tonal range. It seemed like it was worth learning that process.
Now, do you shoot any traditional black and white anymore?
Yeah, I do, a little bit. Tell you the truth, what I've also learned is that I can shoot color and scan and look at the individual channels and get more power out of it that way. Same thing with the plastic camera, by the way. When I'm shooting that series for the gravures or palladiums, I was always putting in a black and white negative, but then I realized if I put the color in, then since it's going to be scanned anyway, I've got the red, green, and blue channel to look at and see what strengths they contribute to the black and white. And so I shoot less black and white now than I have been.
That's a very interesting thought. A lot of people love to shoot black and white only, and they don't want to deal with color. And then when you deal with color, in theory, there's less latitude and dynamic range than there is with black and white. But I think to do true black and white, it's almost like you need to see colorless.
Yes.
I always find a problem with it. It's like, okay, why would I want to put black and white film on my camera when I'm seeing color? I don't understand that, but it's cool when you get a great black and white shot because of the tonal range, but I always find it weird. Okay, how do I block out color? I mean, yes, you can buy a filter and everything sort of turns yellow, brownish, weird, monotone, but...
Right. I mean, the world's best black and white photographers, I think they did that. Look at Ansel Adams. When they cross over to color, it's less successful or vice versa. The color photographers usually stay there. And I think it's hard for someone that's shooting digitally these days that wants to shoot in black and white because the power is not to have the camera instantly converted to black and white, but to shoot it in color, then look at all the different possible ways now. And there again, it's overwhelming. But all from channel mixers and so on to look at how you can interpret it as a black and white. You'd have to be pretty strong visually to see the world in black and white, know what tonal ranges you want to capture, then shoot it in color, look at it in color, and experiment with the channels. It'd just be a real steady, clear focus on where you're going.
Yeah, it is quite interesting. So let's talk about what you mentioned on your blog. You put the video up when you were in the cabin back east about the circus and the sideshow and the freaks everywhere. And sometimes the freaks draw you into their tent, and then pretty soon, you've lost focus on reality. You're drinking the Kool-Aid. What's your thoughts on this whole deal about digital post-production, the digital darkroom, and everybody's tagging on you? It's like walking through Tijuana, and there's 1,000 little kids trying to sell you Chiclets. And that's all good and fine because that's their gig, and you should buy some Chiclets because they're yummy, but do you need 1,000 packs of Chiclets?
Yeah, it goes back to a conversation we had, which was, where do you want to spend your time? There's a finite time here on this planet, and I want to be in it. I want to be out there doing it, and less time in front of the monitor. I do know people that love to be in front of the monitor, and that's great. They've got that priority figured out. But I guess here's the thing, and let's make it simple and go back for some people 5-10 years ago, but for me it's current. You put a roll of film in. If you know how to make your exposure, I mean, the thing about this old FM2, my only options are, if the battery goes out, the light meter doesn't work, but I still have an idea how to make the exposure without the meter. So I need to figure out the exposure. I need to control focus. Do I want everything sharp, some of it sharp, none of it sharp? I've got a preview button to do that. I've also got hyperfocal scale on most of my fixed lenses, which I still like the fixed lenses because I've learned that I would rather move myself than have the zoom lens move me. And so just a simple few things, I use those as tools, and if I come back and I get it right, then there's just what we might consider to be traditional darkroom tools in the digital world to use. I'm puzzled. I don't need to make things sharper if they're already sharp. I mean, sure, there are details to this, too. When you scan an image, scan a piece of film, you need to scan it softer and then bring the sharpness back as opposed to over-sharpening. There's all those things that are true. Your digital camera, you don't want to have it set on a real sharp setting. But, I mean, if it's sharp, it's sharp. If the colors are there, they're there. I mean, if you did a good, decent job. And so I know a fair bit about the digital world, and especially in terms of printing, and I reach for the tools that I need, but it's almost like you go into a candy store. Instead of going in to get Chiclets, you go and go, wow, Jujubes, M&M's, bars, wow, it's just overwhelming, and that's what happens. So people walk in not really knowing what tools they need, and they're overwhelmed by all this cool stuff. And sure, it's cool. And the little joke I made in that little video diary was, it's true, though. I've known people have gone into these sideshows, and they've never left. They've never left, and they forget what the main journey's about. So I think the tricky thing right now is to convince the person that's starting that it's about seeing, and then you need a few simple skills. You need to know them real well. And if you get those down, almost everything you bring back is going to be just right. And then you finesse and tweak in little ways. But you surely don't need to depend upon all this stuff. The reality is the stuff is the marketplace, and that's what its new versions are bringing in more money, and that's what drives the world. So that's the overwhelming tidal wave we're against.
What's your thoughts, Eddie, on people that have been shooting digital, they want to get into film that haven't done it? Do you think they should go out and burn through a case of chrome first before they start playing with color neg? Because with color neg, you have so much latitude, you have so much variance and underexposure, overexposure. I think people should learn how to shoot chrome before they move into shooting color neg.
Yeah, chrome's a great way to learn. I mean, because if you're off a stop, you blew it. You're off two stops, there's no way. Whereas you can be off that much in negatives and in digital capture and raw in particular and correct, although I think it's a misnomer to say that you can correct everything in raw. Yeah, I agree with you. I think you should start with chrome film and take some notes, get it back today or tomorrow and look at it carefully, look at your mistakes, figure out why. I mean, I always look at my mistakes because that's why I learned not to do things again. You know, people sometimes say, how many pictures you take and you make are good ones? It's a funny question, but I guess less of them are careless and less of them are sloppy over time because of that early learning with chrome film.
So what are you looking forward to in the future with your photography that you haven't had a chance to do yet? What is keeping Eddie enthused about what's going on? I know we're going to talk about it in a minute. You got a brand new DVD. You have some excellent classes going on with Santa Fe and some other folks. But photographically, what are you looking forward to? What do you want to do that you haven't done?
I mean, the overall answer is I'm going to just fight myself for more time. We talked about this earlier. Because when I'm out there, the good things happen. I just love it. And I want to do several things. I'm working on a series on water. I'm doing some night photography that's new for me. Photographing the natural world, the forest in particular, at night. and having a lot of fun with that. Feel like I'm beginning the journey, so that means there's a lot of excitement still to come. Released a book for called 1,000 Moons, and it was essays about the natural world, 21 of them, and then about 77 images. And I have another book like that in mind. So visually, creatively, those projects, some writing photo projects, some new interpretations of water and forest. And then I do love teaching, too. As you're alluding to, this DVD is coming up and a couple other educational ideas that are just right around the corner.
So let's talk about your teaching. If I sign up and go to one of Eddie's classes, what do you teach? What am I going to learn from what you're conveying? What are you going to teach me?
The core class I've taught for, hard to believe, I think it was 95 I started it. The core class that I call The Natural Eye. And what I wanted to do was sort of basically on my path, which back to when I dropped the camera in the salt water and stopped photographing and started seeing, Natural Eye has two big ideas. One is to help people see the natural world with fresh eyes. So part of the workshop got some fun creative exercises and ideas without cameras to help people see reflections and color and texture and so on. So it's really seeing the natural world with fresh eyes. And then the second part is to bring the technical skills of photography up to your ideas and your eyes. Usually I teach it in a week, and the week weaves together both these, I call them stepping stones to seeing, and then sort of fine-tuning thoughtful ideas. Everything from simple things like paying attention to the edges before you trip the shutter and looking at the separation of key elements. And so there's a thoughtful technical side, not immersed in Photoshop, but just basic exposure thoughtfulness and compositional thoughtfulness that supports the seeing. I've been doing that for almost 15 years, and it seems to morph and change and get better and better, but I was getting more and more ideas. So this year I'm going to do a weekend workshop, and for the moment calling it Eyes Wide Open, and it's going to be all about creative ways of seeing. And it's going to be less concerned about the technical side. I want it to be open to anybody that has any kind of camera, because it's going to be more about just a fun weekend of seeing everything from reflections and movement and depth to conceptual ideas and interpretation of ideas. So it's on the drawing board right now.
No, I think this is going to be very cool, because like you said, look at just reflections. How often are you around and you don't see reflections? You don't look for stuff. It's stuff you just pass over that are very cool. So I think taking a class like this to be able to learn to look for different things and to teach people where to look for stuff is really cool.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. The idea is when you drive home and you go, wait a second, I didn't even notice what happened to the last four blocks. Or you don't notice that something's been on that block for 10 years. It's really going to be an effort to get people to see. It's going to be fun. Julie Dean Workshops down in L.A. asked me to do something this May for a weekend. So I thought I'd start it there, give me some time this winter to get new sessions and ideas together. Because I think a workshop should be more than just people make pictures and you review them and then they go back out again. I'm a big believer in surrounding them with real hands-on ideas in addition to letting them make photographs and then thoughtfully reviewing them. Yeah, I'm excited about it.
Very cool. So let's talk about your website, your blog, where people can find out about what you're up to. You got a lot of stuff cooking and a lot of cool things happening. I know you have a newsletter. Tell me where all this stuff's at, Eddie.
Yeah, there's so much going on. I've been on the road continuously, and now here it is end of November, and I'm home for at least 2 months, and everything's going to move forward now. So put together a DVD that is going to go to the, I guess you call it press, the publisher. I mean, we're self-publishing, but it's going to go be made next week, and that's taking a natural eye, the workshop, and bringing it to video, but also putting me in the field with a camera, and then having, what is it, about 10 adventures where I'm wireless in the field, making photographs and talking through the photographic process. About 100 minutes, and that should be out mid-December. The website's going through a complete change. The same folks that designed DVD, I've decided to stop doing all the work myself because I'm not a trained designer. So I like what they do, and sometime mid-winter, the website, eddiesoloway.com, will have a new look and have all these different things on it. Another educational thing I've been working on that needs another month or two, a set of photo cards. And on one side will be a photograph, and the other side just probably a couple sentences so far, the way it looks. On sort of creative ways of seeing the world, some thoughtful reminders about making a photograph, sort of bite-sized tips and ideas that people can take with them. And that's very close to being finished. The blog was something a friend of mine challenged me to do, so I did. And of course, I lose momentum when I get busy, but it was a place where I could put ideas and stories. Stories from other people, stories of my own, stories about the photographic journey. I send a newsletter out to former students about every 6 weeks on sort of what's going on in my mind. I do a lot of photo experiences for former students. When we've been together already, we go off and do some other things. So we go into a beautiful place and make photographs together, and it's all about the camaraderie of being with photographers at the end of the day and catching up and so on. So these newsletters keep them all apprised of what's going on.
Eddie, I really appreciate you joining today. Great to have you on Inside Analog Photo with us. We definitely look forward to chatting with you some more. Your workshops, your photography is beautiful. It's great stuff. Your teaching's cool. I've got to see a lot of the stuff that you've been doing, and it's just really cool, and I do appreciate you joining us. Definitely look forward to having you back on the program and chatting with us some more.
Hey, thanks, Scott. It's great to have a buddy out there and be able to talk about all these important ideas in this photographic journey, so thank you so much.
Well, there you go. A natural eye, Eddie Soloway. What a great guy, beautiful photographer, excellent teacher, and an all-around cool guy. Definitely check out his website at www.eddiesoloway.com. The Inside Analog Photography radio program has been brought to you by Fujifilm, making life more colorful over at www.fujifilmusa.com. Our friends at Richard Photo Lab at richardphotolab.com. DR5 over at www.dr5.com. Iger Studios over at igerstudios.com. Upstrap at upstrap-pro.com. And of course, our media partners, APUG, the Analog Photography User Group, over at www.apug.org. Our photography philanthropy partners, George Eastman House International Museum of Photography and Film, over at www.geh.org. I've been your host, Scott Shepard, here on Inside Analog Photography Radio. We'll be back next week with more great analog photography.